Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby, broadcast live to the cosmos on the Heritage Radio Network.
Well, welcome back to Cutting the Curd after a couple weeks worth of hiatus here. We've been on break for various reasons, but most recently the reason was Hurricane Sandy, which came through the East Coast last week and kind of turned everything upside down. But we're happy to be back on the air. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. My co-host, my usual co-host, Sophie Schlesinger, is not here this evening. But I have a guest host, Diane Stemple, a great friend who's actually going to be guest hosting the show for the next couple months while I try to figure out how to be a mom. I'm due on November 20th. So if anyone wants to join the wager, my husband Patrick has set up a betting ring at his meat shop, the Heritage Meat Shop, so you can bet when the baby will be born and get in on the action. But so thank you, Diane, for being here and for offering to help me out with Cutting the Curd for the next little while.
You're welcome. I'm delighted. I'm delighted to join you today, and I'm delighted to guest host while you're on maternity leave.
That is awesome, awesome news. So today's show is kind of an amalgam of a couple different things. We're going to be talking a little bit about Hurricane Sandy and what that's meant for cheese people here on the East Coast. And then we're also going to be talking with Veronica Pedraza, who has been on the show with us before. She's a cheesemaker, formerly at Jasper Hill Farm in Vermont and currently at Meadowood Farm, upstate New York. Veronica, are you with us?
I am,
man. All right. Veronica has been super patient because with all the Hurricane Sandy craziness, it took me way longer than it should have to get to the studio today. So Veronica's been very patient. Thank you.
You're welcome. I have $20 on Thanksgiving.
Oh, nice. I love it. It would be appropriate because Patrick's business, Heritage Foods, you know, they specialize in Thanksgiving turkeys. And in an odd twist of fate, the hospital where I was supposed to give birth originally is closed due to the hurricane, so I had to move hospitals, and I'm actually going to be at the place where Patrick, my husband, was born, so it's pretty funny. If it was on Thanksgiving, it would just be like a major triple whammy of weird coincidences.
That child will be born into a cornucopia.
Absolutely, absolutely. So first, we're going to talk a little bit about Hurricane Sandy and what that's meant for cheese people here in New York City. And I thought, you know, Veronica, it's great to have you on as well, because you were in Vermont last year when Hurricane Irene hit. So you kind of have some perspective on how weather can disrupt the cheese biz from time to time.
I'm also a native Floridian here.
That is true. You were advising me. Okay, so give me your grocery list for a hurricane.
The most significant hurricane that I ever went through was Hurricane Andrew in 1992.
That was a big one.
That destroyed South Florida.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess I shouldn't be like making light of anything because, you know, these are very serious situations for people. But I did laugh when you told me about how New Yorkers shop badly for hurricanes.
I don't know. Buying milk before your power goes out is not a good move. It's a rookie move.
So yeah, you said you made sure you had plenty of booze on hand, And then also, you know, what kind of non-perishables do you like to pick up before storms hit?
Cheese.
Of course. Duh.
Cheese and cookies.
And cookies. Yeah, that's good. Maybe some beef jerky just to round it out. Yeah. But so, yeah, it's actually interesting. I feel like a lot of cheese people here in New York City were caught pretty unawares of just how significant this storm was going to be. We at Saxelby Cheesemongers were lucky in that we moved all of our cheese from our warehouse in Red Hook the day before the storm hit. So even though we, you know, did suffer some flooding there, that it's going to take us a while to get back from, you know, we were able to move our supply of cheese, which was really lucky. Other cheese people in New York had to end up doing the same thing. I know, any cheese shop downtown, Bedford Cheese, at their new location, on Irving Place, they had to move all their cheese. Murray's Cheese in the West Village, which is a huge cheese shop with, you know, underground caves and everything, they had to move all of their cheese. And it's been amazing to see how willing people are to help in these kinds of situations because, you know, we could have really been left in a bad, bad place. You know, we still don't have power down in Red Hook at our warehouse a week later. So it could have been bad, but I feel like, you know, the cheese world is unique and wonderful in that way, in that people are super generous and willing to help each other out in these tough situations. So we're all lucky for that. Did you guys feel any of the effects of Hurricane Sandy up in Cazenovia?
No, I don't know. We were like in some kind of twilight zone because we got a little bit of wind and some rain, but nothing significant. No trees down or anything like that.
Okay.
I was a little disappointed.
Don't be disappointed. That's awesome.
Well, that's how it was.
I was just prepared. I was ready to go.
What were you going to say, Diane?
That's how it was in some neighborhoods in Brooklyn. It hardly rained. The wind howled, but it seemed like it never hit till you watched the news and found out the devastation in all the other neighborhoods.
Yeah, yeah. It was very unevenly spread. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was definitely a strange, I don't know, storm, but definitely impacted a ton of people here.
I think that's typical of hurricanes.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, something we're going to get better at, it seems like, year after year, because they don't, it seems like they're happening more often rather than less often. If anybody has, you know, updates on how different people fared through the hurricane, we'd love to hear it. You can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.com. You know, we can put it up on our Twitter feed and things like that. We just want to make sure that all of our cheesy neighbors are doing well and recovering. Also, some of the people hardest hit by the hurricane were the bigger distributors. The ports in New Jersey were flooded really, really badly. And so some of the, you know, really larger companies have suffered quite a bit, too. So we're hoping that they're all getting back, you know, getting back online and getting everything put back together. But so the other reason for Veronica being on the show tonight is to talk about something that's a little bit lighter, a little bit happier. The Dairy Sheep Association of North America. Did I say that right?
Yep.
Okay, great. we haven't done a show about an organization like this yet, so I'm excited to talk a little bit more about it. The Dairy Sheep Association of North America just recently had their annual symposium. It was down in South Carolina this year?
No, it was in Dulles, Virginia.
Virginia. Sorry.
So right outside of DC.
Awesome. And so I thought it would be interesting for our listeners to hear more about what this organization does, and then also talk more about what your role is in the organization, you know, getting new members and sort of spreading the sheepy word. So can you tell us a little bit about what the organization does and how it started and what happens at the annual symposium?
Okay, so We're basically a trade association, and we're made up of dairy sheep producers, cheesemakers, and anyone within the industry, so suppliers, researchers, and then there's quite a bit of educators involved.
And how many members would you say there are?
Well, to be honest, I have no, I don't have that information. There were about a little over 50 people at this year's symposium, which apparently was pretty light. Normally there's over 100 people that attend.
Okay. Okay. So I interrupted. So you were saying that there are a lot of educators, and so the symposium largely consists of what kind of programming? Like, what do you get out of it as a cheesemaker?
Well, there wasn't a whole lot that was geared towards cheesemaking. There's a lot that's geared towards more of the dairy side and the animal well-being side, which is important to learn as a cheesemaker. So I got a whole new sort of education going to this conference, just because the health of the animal is relative to the quality of the milk, and that's a real big challenge for dairy producers in the United States, just because we're not allowed to import genetics from France and overseas, where dairy sheep have really been bred for the purpose of cheesemaking. So we have some limitations in terms of our resources available to us right now.
So this is kind of the group to go to if you have sort of questions about how to raise dairy sheep and how to breed dairy sheep. And yeah. Oh, I think Diane has a question.
Veronica, what do you mean by we can't import genetics? Do you mean actual kinds of sheep?
Actual kinds of sheep and, a good portion of, like, cow genetics, right? There's a lot of, I hesitate to say genetic engineering, but you have a lot more in terms of selection. There's concerns about disease, basically.
And what?
Foot and mouth disease. Coming over from Europe into this country.
Ah, okay. Right, because there was that case, I think back in the 90s now, Linda Falaise, that woman in Vermont who had their herd of sheep seized by the FDA and destroyed. I mean, what a terrible thing.
Yeah, and they later found out that was actually government error, but we're not allowed to, the cow dairy, for example, they're, you have a rich genetic pool to sort of look to as a producer, and you can, basically kind of figure out what you want in terms of a dairy cow, and you have that available to you. And sheep, we don't really have that accessibility.
And I mean, there's not much history of sheep dairy here in the United States, right? I mean, I feel like we're more of like a lamb eating country, maybe, than we are a sheep cheese eating country traditionally.
Sure. If you want to become a dairy sheep producer, there's some serious barriers to entry into that industry. One is we don't have, if your parents have a cow dairy, and they're struggling to figure out a way to make it viable, you can sort of turn that into a cheese-making operation here, or you have that opportunity, but nobody's really inheriting sheep dairy farms from their families. And the farms, just the infrastructure on farms that currently exist, like if you wanted to be a producer, say I wanted to go out and buy a farm and start a sheep dairy, a lot of the designs of old barns are designed for cows. They're not designed to house sheep or really small ruminant animals.
Right, right, right. And then there's the added, difficulty of how much milk sheep produce versus how much milk cows produce. A couple of weeks ago, Veronica and I went around the city meeting with different chefs and tasting her cheeses out with everybody. Veronica, as I said, is a cheesemaker at Meadowood Farms up in upstate New York. And I really liked the way that you broke it down for chefs, explaining how much milk you're dealing with sheep versus cows. Can you tell our listeners those numbers real quick? I think they're fascinating.
If you wanted to produce the same amount of cheese annually, you would need 45 cows, 300 sheep, or 600 goats.
Wow.
Yeah. That's crazy.
So with all the difficulty involved in sheep farming, why would people go out of their way to do it? Because they love the sheep milk cheese or the quality of the milk, or what's in it for them?
Well, as a cheesemaker, I mean, sheep's milk has some really unique properties to make cheese, so it's super desirable, like raw product.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the other added benefit of raising sheep is that they're a multi-purpose animal. You know, in order to make milk, you have to have babies, and 50% of those are not going to be, you know, useful. So there's going to be a lamb business, and there's going to be a little bit of wool in it for you. So, and I think some people are, you know, more geared towards the seasonality of dairy sheep.
Which is what, pretty much, the seasonality?
Springtime through sort of mid-fall, most people are kind of, you know, we've just bred all our sheep, and they will lamb in roughly in April. So, you know, I mean, there are ways to manipulate sheep into giving milk year-round, and there are dairy producers that do that in this country, but for a lot of people, especially for people that have farmstead cheese operations, it's a seasonal-based business for them.
Now, that brings up another funny story. Will you tell our listeners the story about the sheep breeding on your farm and the public outcry that it mistakenly caused?
Oh, okay. So the sheep are divided up into various breeding groups, and the ram has basically it's a kind of paint. It's like a vegetable oil and chalk mixture that gets rubbed kind of all over the ram, and the purpose of that is so that basically he marks the ewe. so that you know that it's been bred. For whatever reason, we use red, and we also use blue. But a lot of people driving by the farm thought that the animals were marked for slaughter.
So funny. No, you're like, nope, they had a good time. They enjoyed it. But yeah, I just thought that was hilarious. You go, so word to the wise, if you're driving through, you know, if you're driving past a field full of sheep and, you know, they have crazy colorful markings on their backs, they're not being abused. It's just, you know, just breeding season. That's
breeding.
All. Yeah. Oh, man. But so getting back to, you know, why would anyone want to be a sheep dairy person if this is so difficult? Do you see a lot of people trying to get into the business, or is it just kind of, you know, something that, you know, if a couple, you know, crazy enterprising people have picked up on and are doing, and it's a small community?
Oh, there's definitely a mix of crazy in there. but there's definitely some people that have made the transition from cow dairying into sheep dairying, which I always find interesting. And I think those are the most, like, sort of opportunistic entrepreneurial spirits, just because they realize that there's, you know, there's a market for their product. And then I think that there are some people that are just genuinely interested in, you know, the sort of the multi-purpose animal and having a farm that is multi-purpose.
Right, right. Like I know Three Corner Field Farm, which is a farm that we buy quite a bit of cheese from, they seem to have a very good handle of that market. They have great lamb. They make sheep milk cheeses. They make yogurt. They sell the fleece, you know, the wool. They sell sheep milk soap. And so, yeah, there is an opportunity for a smaller scale business that's also very viable for a family. So what were the goals or the outcomes from this year's Dairy Sheep Association conference? What did you guys walk away, you know, wanting to accomplish for next year?
Well, we need to grow membership, and we also need to sort of recruit the next generation of American dairy sheep farmers. I would say that, you know, the organization as it is, at least the attendees this year, you know, we're older people.
You're not old. Oh, they were older people. I thought you said we're older people. And I was like, Veronica, you're like 30.
No, I mean, but we need people in their 20s and 30s who are thinking about, you know, maybe people that are interested in farming to kind of take up the interest of dairy sheep. Because there's a lot of, you know, sort of issues that we have to compete with to make this sort of a viable industry in this country. You know, we have to, as cheese producers, we have to compete with, European markets, and a lot of those dairy sheep farmers are subsidized, which is why you see sheep smoked cheese from Italy and from Spain costing basically half the price of domestic sheep smoked products. So, you know, I mean, we need more people to produce milk, and we need more people to produce cheese.
And where is most of the production of milk happening right now, sheep milk?
Ooh, that's interesting. We're definitely a scattered group of people. There's a big initiative, obviously, in Wisconsin, because there's a research facility at Spooner, which is one of the branches of the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And they started the Sheep Dairy Cooperative, or the Wisconsin Sheep Dairy Cooperative, which produces the cheese Dante.
That's such a good cheese.
It's probably one of the most ubiquitous domestic sheep cheeses. But there was a good concentration of people in New York and some in Virginia and the Maryland area. And then out west too, in Washington, because obviously there's a lot of ranchers raising sheep out in Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, etc. And so I think it's just sort of a natural inclination for people out there to be interested in making sheep milk cheese.
Hmm.
What climates are good for sheep milk?
What climates are
Yeah,
good?
I mean, as you know, like goats don't need as much grass as cows. Where do sheep fit in that difference?
Sheep graze definitely differently than cows or goats. They kind of nip the grass sort of all the way down to the butt.
Mm-hmm.
But colder climates obviously work well for animals, particularly just because of parasites. Small ruminant animals are affected a little bit more heavily by parasites and disease, which exist in like warmer climates. So the type of sheep that you have, too, has a little bit to do with it. You don't really want to raise sheep in, like, Louisiana when they've got a wool coat and it's 90 degrees out in August.
That makes for some pretty miserable sheep.
Yeah.
Now, do sheep get, like, mad at you visibly? Like, you know, do they have personalities like goats do? Goats are kind of, like, vindictive and, like, mischievous. And what's their temperament like?
I might, you know, catch some heat for this, but I would say dumb.
That's what I've heard.
Not lovable, but dumb? Are they lovable?
What's that?
Are they lovable, but dumb?
Oh, they're very lovable. I mean, they're very, well, when they're young, they're cute, you know. Most animals are cute when they're young, and then the older they get, they're just more like animals, but.
Absolutely. Oh, that's funny. So where do people learn about this Dairy Sheep Association of North America, and what are some other resources that you could point to for people who are interested in sheep dairy?
Ooh, other resources. Well, the University of Wisconsin at Spooner would be for, I guess, breeding stock. They've done probably the most research into dairy sheep. Obviously, the Dairy Sheep Association of North America. But otherwise, I mean, there's not a lot of resources out there for people. And something that's of interest to me is kind of bridging the gap between, like, North American and European producers, because we have a lot to learn from Europe's dairy sheep producers.
Yeah, now you mentioned you're going to a workshop at VIAC, the Vermont Institute of Artisan Cheese, pretty soon here. Did they have visiting sheep cheesemakers that come over and kind of share their knowledge?
I've never seen a specific sheep cheese class with VIAC. They're definitely producers that make sheep's milk cheese who teach some of the classes.
Nice.
The class I'm attending this week is the business of, it's like business planning for cheesemakers.
Oh man, yeah, not the fun part, but very necessary part.
Yeah.
Well, I guess in closing, you know, it's funny, we're almost out of time, but I want people to know more about your farm. Can you tell us a little bit about Meadowood Farms and the cheeses you're making up there?
Sure. Okay, so we're located in Cazenovia, New York, which is right outside of Syracuse. I like to say that we're the gateway to the Finger Lakes. We have 225 acres that are devoted to, we raise, this coming year we'll have 135 milking ewes, and we also have 50 belted Galloway beef cattle that we raise for both beef and breeding stock. Our farm was originally built in 1910 by the Walter Sharp family, so it's sort of historic in nature. And over the generations, it sort of got parceled out and became derelict at some point. But in 1996, Mark Chappell and Tom Anderson purchased the original property and sort of began the process of restoring the property and making it a working farm again. So right now we make cheese. We obviously raise beef. We have lamb. We do a little bit of wool and yogurt.
Yum, and yum and warm.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, and the cheeses that you make are awesome. Rippleton is a washed rind sheep cheese. Ledyard is a sheep's milk cheese that's kind of like a banon from Provence. It's wrapped in a grape leaf that's locally harvested and soaked in a beer from Empire Brewing Company. It's a wheat beer infused with Concord grapes. Did I get that right?
Yeah, it's an expression of like Madison County terroir. The grapes come from Madison County. The leaves come from Madison County. The milk and cheese obviously come from there too.
Awesome. That is awesome. And then Lorenzo, which is a more recent addition, and that one is kind of like a Fontina style sheep's milk cheese that's washed with a cider, and a barely fermented cider, and that's really delicious as well. So we are proud to carry their cheeses at Saxelby Cheesemongers, but can you, Veronica, can you give everybody a rundown of other places they might find your cheese if they're looking for it?
Sure. In New York, besides Saxelby Cheesemongers, we're also carried at Lucy's Way and Beecher's. In Philadelphia, you can find us at DeBruno Brothers. In the Boston-Cambridge area, you can find us at Formaggio Kitchen. We've been working with a distributor out in Chicago, so you can find us on a couple restaurant menus there. And we'll be in Cowgirl Creamery in D.C., hopefully before the end of the year.
Great.
So you can go down there and get your Christmas cheese.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Veronica, for taking time to talk with us about dairy sheep. Who knew? Such a fascinating world.
I think this should be a regular topic.
I think so too. Well, it's all in Diane's hands from here on out. She's calling the shots. So maybe we can have, like, you know, a monthly sheep rundown.
Or maybe we can rotate cow, goat, and sheep.
There you go.
Yeah, that would be fair.
The status of sheep in 2013. Like, I'll be your foreign correspondent.
Great.
That sounds awesome.
I need one.
Yeah. Well,
literally foreign.
Yeah, Casanova's not that far up there. Come on. You're
I just meant rural.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for being on the show. We know we'll have you back on again at some point in the future. And so, yes, signing off for a couple months, and Diane will be signing on. So everybody keep enjoying your Cutting the Curd, and we'll be back next Monday with a fresh episode.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today.
Thanks for listening.